Under the Golden Dome is supported by the Iowa Bankers Association. Bankers across Iowa are ready to help Iowans reach their financial goals to get them where they want to go. Learn about the difference of Iowa banks by following Iowa Bankers on Facebook and Twitter.
This is Under the Golden Dome, an Iowa public radio show about the legislative session. I'm John Pimble. Your brain has opioid receptors. They process pain and pleasure. If you take a drug like morphine, it can alleviate physical pain while also delivering an intoxicating experience. Morphine is an example of an opioid drug. Pills like oxycodone or Percocet are also opioids. An opioid drug is prescribed to patients needing pain management after a surgery. It can also be prescribed after a severe physical injury. Opioids are addictive. In 2017, around 200 people died in Iowa from an opioid drug overdose.
Again, I believe this is a Board of Pharmacy bill.
Lawmakers are looking for solutions to curb opioid drug abuse. One of them is to eliminate paper prescriptions to stop forged orders.
This bill would require, as of July 1st, 2019, that all prescriptions transmitted to a pharmacy be done so in an electronic format.
Andrew Funk, executive director of the Iowa Board of Pharmacy, speaks to a Senate Human Resources Subcommittee about a bill written by his department.
Right now, about 65% of non-controlled prescriptions are being submitted to pharmacy on electronic means. And then we've got about 9% of controlled substances that are being transmitted by electronic means.
Opioids are classified as a controlled substance, where something like an antibiotic is classified as a non-controlled substance.
And when we talk about an electronic prescription, we're not talking about fax or printing something and emailing it. We're talking about it going from the physician's computer directly into the pharmacy system's dispensing software.
Funk says Iowa has been able to electronically prescribe controlled substances since 2010.
In Iowa, we've got 9% of our prescriptions being done so through that electronic means.
The United States Controlled Substances Act, established in the 1970s, classifies and regulates powerful drugs and their medical use or potential for abuse. There are five classifications known as schedules. Funk says fraud for drugs classified under Schedule 2, or as they are often called, C2, are a problem.
You give a patient a prescription, which historically you have to do with a C2, or you would do with a C2, they have that prescription in their hand and can attempt to make copies, can attempt to alter numbers. Patients have, in the past, stolen prescription pads from practitioners and written their own prescriptions. The electronic prescription requirement would entirely eliminate that piece of potential fraud.
Lobbyist Dennis Tibben from the Iowa Medical Society says his group supports the intent behind the bill, but
our concern lies in the logistics of this. In speaking with our folks, especially our folks even at the large systems, and I won't speak for the systems that are all represented here today as well, they're moving towards being able to electronically prescribe controlled substances, but especially with the Schedule II controlled substances, it requires additional levels of technology and capacity to be able to do so. They're in the process of rolling that out, but the July 1, 2019 date may be unattainable for a lot of folks, let alone for our smaller rural hospitals and rural physician practices around the state. So we would recommend, if you move forward with this legislation, that you move that implementation date to July 1, 2020, just to make sure that we are not setting ourselves up for failure and that we can actually roll this out in a timely fashion and organized manner.
Lobbyist for Walgreens, Karen Sisson, points out how the state of New York rolled out a similar program, but it took a few years to implement.
It took about 4 years because I think, as Dennis said, there are some issues in terms of rural technology considerations. However, I think that's why it's important that there are those exemptions or hardship exemptions that are reapplied for on an annual basis. But with New York, so they had full implementation in March of 2016, within the first 3 months. You saw a reduction in dental prescribing of more than 30% in just hydrocodone alone.
Chair of the subcommittee, Senator Tom Green, a retired pharmacist, says he understands the need to push an implementation date back, but he has a problem waiting for it to take effect as late as 2020.
I think this is obviously a way that we can do our part to help curb the abuse of controlled substances. I mean, I've so blatantly had people hand me a handwritten prescription, and the doctor wrote for, it was 10 sleeping pills, basically, and they changed the 10 to a 4, the 1 to a 4, easy change. But they didn't use the same color ink. I mean, it's like those people who are out to abuse the system and manipulate the system are going to continue. This is a step that we can do our part to ensure that the intended drug, the intended number of dosages is accurate. And we've been using electronic prescribing and reception of prescriptions in our pharmacy in Burlington for a number of years. I'll bet 3 or 4. So this is just so that the prescriber becomes verifiable and the dispensary becomes verifiable, the pharmacy. So I think these are positive steps. And I understand if the commission would like to, or if our senators would like to consider that, putting it off to 30 months, then that's, but I think the sooner the better, in my opinion.
Well, I understand the immediacy. I understand that.
Senator Liz Mathis is a member of the subcommittee.
You know, we have a Medicaid issue, and there is a lot of outstanding debt right now. And if hospitals do have this in a phase where they have already budgeted for it or they know what they're going to be doing with it, I would say, okay, that would be harmless. But I think in this context where we are right now, where many hospitals have between 8 and maybe 18% of their population Medicaid payment, and they have outstanding claims, and it's pretty hard right now to balance some budgets around the state of Iowa, given the context of how we're talking about this. So, I'm a little nervous about this date for some groups that might not be able to meet this date, but yet I understand the immediacy of it.
The subcommittee chooses not to advance it because there need to be changes. This meeting happened at the end of January. 1 week later, they meet again to address the concerns.
First of all, first thing we're going to do is change the implementation date on the amendment from July 1st of 2019 to January 1st of 2020. This just gives those another 6 months to comply, and they can always petition for a waiver after that point if they have issues. But, you know, a lot of people put it off and put it off and put it off, but this is something that will be beneficial for the majority of people.
Senator Green also addresses what to do in the event an electronic connection is temporarily unavailable.
Bingo, internet goes down.
Yes. Mm-hmm.
This happens in the real world too. Page 2, lines 18 and 19, by striking and shall not be released. And then we're going to insert, a pharmacist who receives a written, oral, or a facsimile prescription shall not be required to verify that the prescription is subject to an exception under paragraph C and may dispense a prescription drug pursuant to an otherwise valid written, oral, or faxed prescription. However, a pharmacist shall exercise professional judgment in identifying and reporting suspected violations of this section to the board or the appropriate professional licensing board of the practitioner.
Green says when the technology doesn't work, a pharmacy still has to be able to function.
Well, I tell you, most pharmacies are dead in the water when the internet's down. I mean, we still got antibiotics, and we still keep a manual typewriter just for those. And then you got to go back and re-enter all the data and redo the billing. You have no way of billing or knowing copays. It's, oh, geez. Yes.
The bill allows for a waiver to be applied for a full year if an organization doesn't have the technology to go all electronic if this becomes law in January 2020.
We'll move it on to the full committee.
Green and the two other panelists signed the paperwork for Senate Study Bill 3074 to move on.
Yeah, with amendment.
Yeah.
Thank you.
Under the Golden Dome is supported by the Iowa Bankers Association. Bankers across Iowa are ready to help Iowans reach their financial goals to get them where they want to go. Learn about the difference of Iowa banks by following Iowa Bankers on Facebook and Twitter.
This is Under the Golden Dome, a show about the legislative session from Iowa Public Radio. I'm John Pimble.
What we're seeing now is that people are starting to use drugs not with prescription pills, but with heroin.
Dr. Chris Burrish, professor of emergency medicine at University of Iowa, is talking about another kind of opioid, heroin. Sometimes heroin is left out of the opioid discussion because it is illegal. The drug is most often injected into the bloodstream with a needle. Burrish is at the Capitol for a meeting to explain to lawmakers what a heroin user goes through. Burrish says when heroin is injected with a needle that is shared by another person, it's possible for the virus hepatitis C to spread because this virus is transmitted through blood.
And so we've seen huge rises in hepatitis C throughout the country, but especially in here in Iowa as well. And we don't even really know, truthfully, the extent of the hepatitis C epidemic that we're facing, because not very many people have been tested. You don't have symptoms usually for 30 or 40 years after you contract the virus. And so this virus is sort of slowly burning its way through our population, and it leads to, after a few decades, liver failure and hepatocellular carcinoma or liver cancer. And the only cure for that is really expensive medications like the Harvoni treatment, which up until recently was about $100,000 per person, or a liver transplant, which is $1 million or so per person. And so this is a big deal. And as this epidemic kind of approaches, as it shows up, it's not only going to bring opioid deaths, but it's going to bring all of these other things along with it. And that's where needle exchange comes into play.
A needle exchange program provides free needles without questions. Proponents say these help lower the risk of HIV or hepatitis C infections. These kind of programs exist in other states. To advocate for a needle exchange program in Iowa, the Iowa Harm Reduction Coalition Executive Director Sarah Ziegelhorn cites alarming data from the Centers for Disease Control.
In November of 2017, the Iowa Department of Public Health submitted a request to the CDC, and the request was called the Determination of Need, and it was a set of statistics that are used to measure the likelihood of an HIV outbreak in the state. Among these statistics, IDPH reported that we have a 375% increase over 6 years in hepatitis C among people who use drugs under age 30. So young folks in the state are now, whereas once we had a pill crisis, there's some data that I'll ask Representative Eisenhart to send around that shows we've dramatically switched from folks starting out with pills and then getting into heroin, but now we have folks starting with using heroin and starting off with using syringes and then transmitting hepatitis C. To support that, the department sent the CDC data that said injection use had risen 58% in 5 years for heroin users and 73% for meth users. So what once in the state was a crisis of meth use among people smoking it or snorting it, it's now primarily injecting it.
Ziegelhorn says the CDC recommends a needle exchange program as a solution to reduce the spread of these diseases. But in Iowa, such a program would be illegal.
Currently, the Drug Paraphernalia Code, Iowa Code 124, Section 414, says that the distribution of syringes is for an unlawful purpose, which is illicit substance use, is classified as a simple misdemeanor. The bill that we have proposed with Senators Dawson, Senator Zahn, and a number of other folks on the Senate Judiciary Committee would change the paraphernalia law to allow a legal purpose for syringe exchange, or would allow a legal syringe distribution through public health programs sponsored by the Iowa Department of Public Health. And so it would not be saying that the law allows anyone to carry hypodermic needles or syringes, but that it is legal to obtain them through a syringe exchange program.
Ziegelhorn says the data from the state of Washington, where there is a needle exchange program, helps reduce drug use.
When individuals came and engaged in a needle exchange, they were 2.5 times more likely to reduce the number of times they used drugs in a week than people who had never gone to the syringe exchange. Not only that, but they were 3.5 times more likely to stop injecting drugs altogether, and they were 5 times more likely to enter drug treatment programs.
She says the centers don't serve just as a place to exchange syringes for drug use.
It's that they're having conversations around HIV and hepatitis C testing, they're connecting people who are homeless into housing, and they're making connections into treatment. And so one thing I'd like to do is I'll send you these slides later, but in a pilot program that we're setting up here at the university and between our program that can be easily replicated to any treatment program in any community in the state, we walk through the steps with people that come to our program looking for treatment that make it easier for them to get in. Because I know that all of you have heard how hard it is to get drug treatment in our state. And a lot of that is because we don't have enough providers. But the other half of it is that it's really hard if you're sick and you have an addiction and you've been using for some time. It's hard to wait for 6 hours on the phone to schedule the appointment, to go through the Medicaid application process, to find a ride to take you there, to make sure you've got your appointments scheduled in the right order. It honestly, it's a full-time job sometimes for me to, as even a person in the healthcare field, to get someone to treatment. And so these programs streamline that process and they essentially create a red carpet into treatment for the people in their programs.
Dr. Chris Burrish says the notion that people addicted to drugs keep using because it is fun is false.
I mean, nobody grows up thinking, or, you know, I want to be a junkie, right? Like, I just went to my daughter's preschool graduation and they stood up and I want to be a police officer and I want to be a teacher and I want to be a doctor. Nobody stood up and said, I want to be a junkie. Right? It just doesn't happen. And so people that are addicted to these drugs know that if they don't get the drugs, they get sick and they feel like they're going to die. And so they spend so much of their time and effort and money and the time that they could spend, you know, working a job, taking care of their kids, doing the things that we all have to do every day, is spent just trying to avoid going through withdrawal. And so a lot of these people want to stop using. But they feel like every time they think about going to the doctor or talking to somebody about it, they get judged. You know, it's just not a comfortable environment. You know, they don't want people to think, oh, you're a junkie, you're, you know, a dropout, you're whatever. And so by engaging with people where they're at through these programs, they learn that they can engage with the system without without being judged and in a helpful and you know, sort of collaborative way.
This week, Sarah Ziegelhorn and supporters of Iowa Harm Reduction Coalition have an advocacy day at the Capitol. It's to gain support for Senate Study Bill 3008, an act allowing needles and syringes to be legally distributed in an approved needle exchange program. Ziegelhorn gives advice on how to engage legislators.
For many of you, because most folks in this room are from Cedar Rapids, Iowa City, and Des Moines, many of you already have very supportive legislators who are very supportive of syringe exchange. And so that is why today we won't be just focusing on having community members talk only with their direct representatives and senators, but you will be speaking to these folks as experts and calling out folks from the chamber from around the state who need to hear about the work that we're doing and about the benefits of syringe exchange programs.
One of the people here is Kent Hoskinson.
I got into addiction at a very young age, 12 or 13. Was using a needle by the time I was 16.
Hoskinson is in his late 50s. He's used drugs for most of his life. He's from Iowa, but as a young man, he moved to Florida
to get where the drugs were, and became addicted to heroin, got strung out. I did all the bad things you can think of. I went through it, the withdrawals in jail, the losing loved ones, losing friends. Not only the ones that overdosed, but the good people that kicked me out of their life because of who I was. That hurt a little worse. I was revived with Narcan once I overdosed. All of the bad things, all the jail and everything. And then I got into recovery and started researching how I could help. And basically spending my time that I used to chase drugs, I was spending researching, and I learned so much stuff that's been being done wrong, and I want to help change that.
When did you come back to Iowa? You said you're in Florida for a period?
Yeah, for about 20 years in Florida, and I burned all my bridges, ended up in jail, and as a last resort escape, I came back to Iowa and went into rehab. It didn't help. I managed to cut down on the heroin I use because it's harder to get up here. But then I started doing more meth. So it didn't help much moving up here. But
there's always this question, like, you know, when people that escape from addiction, there's that point. What was the point for you?
Okay, that's a great question. A lot of people in recovery talk about the rock bottom. I don't really believe in that so much. I went through so many rock bottoms, but I would always just think it out and say, stay the course, just keep taking drugs till it kills you. And then finally, at one point, I was 48 years old, sitting in jail on a possession charge. I didn't have anything but a few pairs of clothes in my pickup truck, which was a piece of junk and was impounded. And it just dawned on me that drugs weren't killing me fast enough. And it was just making things worse, and there was no end in sight. And so I think a moment of clarity is very important. You've got to have that moment of clarity where you think, I want to stop. Because if you don't want to stop, you're not going to. You can't be forced to stop. You can't do it for other people. You have to really want it, you know.
The exchange program has a lot of goals. Some of it is to bring people together who have something in common. And I don't want to put words in the mouth of someone who's been a long-term user, but at least they know that this isn't a good idea. Does that sense of community that can come from an exchange program when people are around each other help start those conversations?
Definitely. Yes, that's a great point. Doing the outreaches we do, we get to meet, and it takes a while to get their trust. Of course, the stigma, they have to hide it. That's just how it works. But we can finally gain their trust and talk about things. And that community of users you talk about, you know, they're scared, they're hurting. They might put on a front, but they're in a bad place. And this program, we get to talk to them. Eventually, of course, treatment comes up. They have to be ready for treatment, but we can at least be there. And then telling them that we're there and we care is huge. Nobody cares about these people. In fact, most people hate them and want them dead. But we care, you know. I think that does a lot for them. I know it does. I've seen what it does.
When you're here at the Capitol to talk to legislators about this bill, what is it that you're telling them?
Just like to try and quickly get them in the mindset of when you're in addiction, you don't need a clean needle. You're going to get that drug in your vein no matter what. And so the idea of holding back clean needles as any sort of help is really kind of ridiculous. It doesn't make sense to me.
Would a program like this have helped you back in your bad days?
Yeah, sure. Like I said, all the bad things you can imagine I went through, I would have definitely benefited from clean needles. And somebody caring or talk of treatment. I don't know. The what ifs, we'll never know. You know, if I'd have never did it in the first place, who knows? I could have been an astronaut maybe, but I can't really play the what ifs thing.
Did you suffer any health effects from bad needles?
Yes, I did.
What are those effects?
I got hepatitis C. I just found out just recently. I'm in treatment now. It's all good. I got good insurance and all. So it's not a problem for me. But that doesn't mean it makes me all the more obligated to try and help the people that don't have good insurance. Even with my insurance, I had to jump through quite a few hoops and wait for 3 months to get treatment while they drug tested me to make sure I wasn't using drugs, which was 3 months wasted. I don't know how much damage that caused my liver. Probably not much, but I don't understand the concept of even if I was using, why would that make my life any less valuable?
It's February 2018. How long has it been since you stopped using?
September 30th, 2011 is my official date. I don't really count clean time that much. I focus on happiness and a meaningful life, abstinence or being clean. None of that stuff really is part of my recovery.
Kent Hoskins says part of his recovery is helping and listening to drug users. He discovered the Iowa Harm Reduction Coalition last year through Facebook recovery groups. Near the end of this day, the Senate Judiciary Subcommittee takes up the Needle Exchange Program bill. The room is filled with supporters. The chair, Senator Dan Dawson, is a former police officer and now works with the Major Crimes Unit with the Iowa Division of Criminal Investigation. Senator Dawson says his colleague, Senator Brad Zahn, approached him about this kind of bill last summer. Dawson says at first, he was skeptical about the idea of distributing needles to drug users, in part because of his background in law enforcement.
But as the summer progressed, talking to some individuals, and during our two-day opioid committee during October, I got a lot of research, a lot of reading materials to take home, and I am 100% convinced that needle exchange program does mitigate infectious diseases. I think the data is clearly out there, and I think from a public health standard and perspective, that's probably paramount where we need to go with this. I'm certainly supportive of moving this forward. I do want to move this forward. I received some information from the Department of Public Health. We might need to address a few things in rules-wise, but I think we can all kind of come together on that just to clarify a few things, reference type of program. But I thank everyone for being here today, and I will support the bill.
Senator Dawson, Bolton, and Zahn signed the bill to go before the full Judiciary Committee. Senator Zahn, author of this bill, says before this summer, he was unaware of how a needle exchange program in Iowa could work.
I'm not condoning drug use, but the reality is there's two. This is about a public health is what this is about. So I feel very confident that this is the right thing to do, and I plan on running it in committee next week.
Senator Zahn says if the bill goes through the committee, he isn't sure if Majority Leader Bill Dix will bring it to the floor, nor is he certain about what the House may do. The next day, during a Republican leader's press conference, House Speaker Linda Uppmeyer is asked about the support a needle exchange program may have in the House.
Those discussions are going on, and people have actually come into the Capitol to make presentations. I think one of the best ways to describe it is people go in maybe thinking about it in one way. They have a conversation, they leave the room thinking about it a little differently. So I think it's really a process for not just legislators, but even Iowans to become educated on and think more about. As I've said before, I think it's an opportunity for a spot for intervention. But even I am not convinced it's necessarily the right way to go. But it's certainly something we're talking about and we're exploring. I think we need to explore all the avenues that might be out there. And I think the physicians are on board with that. They just want a system that works.
Uppmeyer also announced legislation designed to monitor the prescribing of legal opioid pills. Most of the stories coming from the Capitol often put the Republicans and Democrats at odds with each other. This is normal when a majority party controls the House, Senate, and Governor's office. It makes for divisive bills, and you hear a lot about them. Today's show focuses on two bills concerning opioids, where there seems to be agreement with the two parties. It will probably be pretty rare that I can produce a show about this General Assembly, where there isn't a great divide between Republicans and Democrats on a big issue. This is Under the Golden Dome, a weekly legislative show. I'm John Pimble. Next week, a bill about proposed abortion restrictions and has the kind of passionate disagreement you'd expect. Also, the House and Senate ended this week with different versions of a bill for K-12 funding. It was expected to be signed into law by the governor, but the two chambers need to come to an agreement. They expect to resume debate early next week. We'll talk about these issues on our next episode. I'm very lucky to have help from my Iowa Public Radio News colleagues to make the show. State House reporter Joyce Russell, thank you. Katerina Sestarik, thank you. Thank you, Lindsay Moon, Emily Woodbury, and Ben Stanton, our talk show producers. Iowa Public Radio's news program director is Catherine Perkins. Michael Leland is our news director, who, among many things, provides edit support for our scripts and concepts. Under the Golden Dome is a production of Iowa Public Radio.